Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Economics. This is Andrea Bernardi from Oxford Brookes, your host. Today, I am with Professor Christopher Marquis. We will speak about his latest book. This was published by Yale University Press. The title is Better Business, How the B Corp Movement is Remaking Capitalism. Christopher, welcome. Thanks for your time. Can I ask you to tell us something about your current and past affiliations and the origin of this book?
Yeah, sure thing. Great. Thanks for having me, Andrea. Really looking forward to talking about the book with you today. So how the book came about actually, is very intimately tied with my different affiliations. So I'm currently at Cornell. I've been at Cornell for about 4 to 5 years now. I work on issues of sustainable development and also do some work on sustainability in China. Before that, I spent 10 years and then also about 2 years at Harvard Business School and then Harvard Kennedy School. And the idea for the book came about from during my time at Harvard Business School, and particularly the enthusiasm that my students were having for for-profit social businesses, sort of social enterprises that have a mix of, you know, sort of for-profit and not-for-profit agendas within them. And, you know, I started off when I was at HBS and I was teaching a class on corporate social responsibility, which is, you know, in the past has been a research focus of mine. And one day in class, a student, very smart student said, you know, to study businesses' effects on societies, we should not be studying sort of large companies in their CSR programs. We should be studying companies that have a social mission at their core, like B corporations. And this, you know, I had never heard of B corporations then. This was in 2009, but I learned very quickly. I got in touch with the founders of B Lab, which is a nonprofit organization that certifies B corporations. So B corporations are businesses that are certified for their social and environmental performance. And I wrote an HBS case study on B Lab and their work in 2010. And over the past decade, have been sort of observing and studying this movement, done a number of published case studies, you know, everything from, you know, the first B Corp in China to largest B Corp in the world, which is Danone's North America operation. So it's been a great journey.
This is very nice, interesting, and also humble of you to say that it was, in fact, a student that gave you the idea to dig into this topic. Very interesting. So, by the way, the book is divided into 11 chapters. I would start, you already said, so we are talking about for-profit corporations, but can you tell us about the notion of a benefit corporation in the United States?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. So the benefit corporation, so this is actually a different phenomena, though connected to the B corporation. So, you know, as I mentioned, you know, the B corporation is a certified, the company certified for their social and environmental benefits by this organization, B Lab. And the founders of B Lab, when they first started working on this phenomena of trying to sort of really hold businesses accountable, you know, they ran into, for their social and environmental impact, they ran into the issue that actually in the United States, the way the corporate governance law is, puts shareholders first, called shareholder primacy. And they realized that, you know, if that were not changed, it would be hard to really hold companies accountable for their social impact because, you know, at some point, if they were up for sale or conflict between investors or investors and the leaders of the firm, you know, this principle of shareholder primacy would get in the way of that. So they went about changing corporate law in the United States. And this took a number of years. So corporate law in the United States is based on a state-by-state basis. And, you know, the big kahuna in some respects is Delaware, which is where a lot of the large corporations are headquartered because, you know, they have very, they have specially tailored corporate law in Delaware. So they finally got Delaware passed a number of years ago. And so what the benefit corporation then does is it puts other stakeholders like employees, community, even customers, suppliers, sort of on the same legal playing field as shareholders. And so, you know, I see the two combination of these two elements, the, you know, the benefit corporation, which is sort of the governance, the legal DNA, so to speak, of the company, and then this accountability framework as working together, you know, to really hold companies accountable. I want to mention, however, as well, that, you know, this is not just an American phenomena. So, you know, started in America and B Corp wise, actually more than half of the B Corps are outside the U.S. Benefit corporation law. So, again, sort of started, you know, trying to address this issue in U.S. corporate law. But many countries, because they actually looked to the U.S. and Delaware for their corporate laws, have the same problems. And so, for instance, Italy has passed a benefit corporation law. It was the first non-U.S. Region to do so. Also, Colombia in South America, Ecuador in South America, Canadian province of British Columbia, and is actually under discussion in a number of sort of legislatures around the world. So this is something that, you know, has really spread quite a bit beyond just its American roots.
Thank you. Going back to the accreditation movement, so who are the founders and why should we trust the certifying organization?
Yeah, good question. I think that, you know, people should bear anything that where companies say they're doing good in the world, that people should be skeptical of this first off the bat. So the founders are, there's three founders. They actually were college friends. They went to Stanford together. Two of them went on to found and then another one joined a basketball athletic wear brand. It actually, you know, was a top brand called And One in probably the 1990s, you know, battling Nike and Adidas. You know, there was a cover of Sports Illustrated, the sort of the leading sports magazine in the U.S. That featured this company. So really, so they found this well-known sports brand. And additionally, the third founder worked as an investor. And, you know, I think his last position, he was, I think, the head of Michael Dell's family office or family management company. And so, you know, sort of the two folks that worked as entrepreneurs and had a very socially conscious and driven business. And then one investor, you know, sort of is a good set, I think, of people to found this because you need to understand how the companies work, social businesses work from the inside. You need to be able to, you know, sort of convince investors and get investors on board. So that's sort of the portfolio of the founders. So I think, you know, it's again, sort of the question of authenticity, in some ways, authenticity, is this just greenwashing, I think is a very important one. I think that there's a couple reasons why consumers can be a little bit more confident in this certification than many other, than sort of just companies saying it. So one is if you actually dig into it, it is quite rigorous as far as what it demands of the company. And it's a company level certification. So, you know, companies you know, it has to look at diverse things from, you know, worker treatment to environmental standards to work in communities. And, you know, many companies that are sort of really well known for their, you know, their social commitment have signed on, which I think also gives it some sort of face validity in some ways that, you know, the fact that Patagonia, a company that, you know, has been deeply involved in the U.S. environmentalist movement, Ben & Jerry's, a company that has been, you know, active on many social issues, Danone, long time since the 1970s, has had this sort of double mission of sort of social and economic benefit and really sees sort of health and nutrition as a core capability. So I think that it's something that is rigorous. You know, there's not that many B Corps actually. There's about 3,500, which maybe some people might think that's a lot, but actually, you know, for something that's been around 10 years, you know, it's really not that large of a number given there's probably tens of millions of businesses around the world. So, you know, in sort of my study of it, I've been well convinced that it's a rigorous and useful framework to evaluate business.
Thank you. Let's move to chapter one, which is focusing on interdependencies, not externalities. And if I quote something from the introduction, you say that economic theory based on shareholder primacy says that corporations should limit the cost of externalities to return more money to the shareholders. But this has led us to the crucial tipping point that we find ourselves at today. So what are the externalities and the interdependencies and why we should focus on the interdependencies?
Yeah, good question. So, you know, this idea of externalities is somewhat unpriced resources that companies draw on for their products, for their processes, for, you know, services, you know, so the most sort of easiest one to talk about and most obvious one is carbon. So pollution, you know, companies typically don't have to pay for the pollution that they put into the atmosphere. And so, you know, when you have, you know, particularly in the United States, the sort of very aggressive sort of Wall Street driven focus on shareholders, sort of culture and economic system, you know, it's real easy for CEOs and leaders to say, well, you know, let's save a little money and not actually install that, you know, that equipment to lower the emissions of our factory. Let's you know, sort of return that to the shareholders. And actually, you know, over the past 50 years, as this system of shareholder primacy has evolved, you know, there's been all kinds of things like, you know, stock options, use of stock buybacks, and other ways that, you know, the investors have really, you know, had the upper hand over the other stakeholders. And so the idea of interdependencies is, you know, that, you know, companies can and should see their relationship with stakeholders in a much more sort of long-term fashion. So, you know, instead of, you know, trying to save money on pollution equipment, think about, okay, you know, we live in this community, we are a long-term resident of this community, our workers live in this community, then so let's actually, you know, pay attention to that and not actually put the cost of the future, you know, health and other damage that comes about from large environmental impacts. And so this is something that is not, I don't know, sort of revolutionary. Even some of the biggest traditional investors in the world, there's this guy Larry Fink who runs sort of the largest global investment management company, BlackRock, largest private one. I think that maybe the Japan pension fund is larger. But so Larry Fink has written these very impassioned letters to CEOs over the past number of years, advocating focus more on purpose, focus more on sustainability. And what he says is, you know, what I just said, sort of put another way, is that, you know, if you think about sustainability of the company from an environmental standpoint, you know, that shows that the company is, you know, mitigating long-term risks, likely indicating better management quality. And furthermore, is just sort of more sustainable over the long run. So it's sort of this much more long-term perspective on delivering value to all stakeholders as opposed to just short-term value to shareholders by exploiting these externalities that don't actually have a price on them.
Thank you. If we can move to chapter six, which is employees at the heart of the company, how do they measure that the employees are truly at the heart of the company, and what do they check? For example, union rights, participation of workers, well-being.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's sort of that's the sort of organized labor is something that you get points for in the assessment, whether the company is employee owned or has employee profit sharing. Different benefits, you know, relating to, you know, sort of everything from health and education, you know, sort of maternity, paternity benefits, sort of, you know, a lot of things. You know, this is something where, you know, it's an overall assessment of the company. So every company has, you know, its different sort of flavor in how they actually meet the standard. The standard is 80 out of 200. Which sort of sounds low, but it, you know, from the people that have gone through it, tell me that it's actually very hard to get and very, very rigorous. So it's all of those items. I think there's a big focus, you know, which certainly in the U.S. Nowadays around, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion. So, you know, not just policies, but actually the outcomes. I mean, do you have a diverse workplace? You know, are, you know, women, people of color represented in the senior management of the firm? Are there pay inequities? So the companies have to look at sort of pay levels between different demographic groups. So, you know, what this does by actually, you know, focus on creating sort of a more fair and equitable workplace, and I discuss in the chapter, is, you know, leads to much higher employee retention. And much more successful attraction of employees as well. So this is something that really came through in all the interviews I did for the book. That, you know, what one person told me when people hear they're a B Corp and say, well, why are you a B Corp? What do you get from that? And their answer is, I never have to worry about employees. And what she meant by this is, people never leave because they're treated so well. And when the business is growing and they need to hire new people, there's a long line out the door of people that want to work at the company. And so these actually positive employee practices, you know, have a real economic benefit for the firm through sort of retention and attraction of employees.
That's very interesting. So apparently, I guess at the moment, the impact is stronger in terms of marketing for the potential employees rather than marketing for customers, or at least it seems so.
Correct. I would agree. So if you were to say, and this is something that when I teach a class about this, the students struggle with it because, you know, many times people think, okay, you know, having the B logo and being a socially committed business is something about, you know, the external presentation of the firm to, you know, the millennial consumers, Gen Z consumers, you know, really are excited about this. But I think it's actually this, the employee effects. If you want to think about what the big economic benefit of this is, it's actually through the workplace and HR.
Very interesting. So let's move to chapter number 10, which also addresses a very interesting topic, controversial almost, because you say big isn't always bad. And of course, I agree. And many people should agree. But we live in a world where for decades, we've been told that the big corporations, whatever sector they operate in, should be seen with caution, and if not even considered as evil. So what do you mean to tell us from with this chapter and this title?
Yeah, so one of the things is I've observed this movement for now over 10 years that has really more recently got me very excited about the future of it is that many large companies are now interested in taking on this challenge of being certified. So, You know, the most sort of well-known and prominent one is Danone. This is a $30 billion U.S. dollar company based out of Paris. Currently, over 30% of their overall sales are from their B Corp subsidiaries. So they have about 20 subsidiaries that are certified, largest, as I mentioned, being the North American operation. They've committed, the CEO, Emmanuel Faber, has committed by 2025 to certify the entire global organization. That's, you know, sort of one example that I talk a lot about in the chapter. I did actually published a case study on Danone's experience, Danone North America's experience getting certified. You know, another one from South America, Brazil, is Natura, which is a cosmetics company, long-standing, you know, and focus on environmental ingredients, environmentally sustainable and healthy ingredients. You know, that's a big trend nowadays, but they were a real pioneer of this. Their model is, you know, selling through sort of independent saleswomen. And they see this as a way to help provide economic opportunity and growth to women in Brazil and in other places. And they have, I think, 2 million of these women. They provide sort of training and a way to sort of earn a livelihood. So Natura recently purchased the UK-based The Body Shop and American-based Avon, which is a very large, sort of very well-known in America cosmetics company. Also the same model of you know, individual women sort of selling within their sort of networks and communities. So after these acquisitions, Natura is about a $10 billion company. And so, you know, with these companies that have sort of taken a leadership in becoming part of this movement, there's a groundswell of interest among other leading global companies. And so, you know, for instance, let me say a little bit about those two examples. So, you know, one from Europe, one from South America, and I don't think that's an accident. It's unfortunate, again, sort of this sort of U.S. Wall Street, you know, sort of short-term culture, I think, has really created some issues in the United States with large companies being able to sign up. So I think in both in Europe and in South America, you know, there's a lot of large companies, and I think that, you know, the way capitalism is practiced in those two regions, well, particularly among companies, whereas in, you know, in Europe, much more sort of a, you know, more regulated, greater social focus in companies, and then in South America, you know, a lot more family. A lot of the companies have some family ownership or family background, which is also usually much more long term. So I think, you know, as I look forward, this sort of big isn't always bad. I think there's going to be more and more larger companies going through this, and I think that they're mostly going to be European and South American firms, and that suggest to me that this movement, you know, is even going to become more global, and maybe even the center of gravity of it will shift out of the United States.
By the way, do I remember correctly that the fee for the certification is 0.01 of the sales? So the large memberships, they will bring substantial resources to the organization. Wow. Okay.
Correct. Yeah. And I should mention something too, which is important for, it goes back to your earlier question about whether you should believe this. You know, it's really, for certifying organizations, there's always a tension between, you know, getting fees and, you know, the model is to, the economic model is you get money from the companies that are certified. So you might think there's a natural conflict of interest in actually setting the certification, which I think is a really important point that the B-Lab people have wrestled with quite a bit, because it's obvious tension. So one thing is obviously organizing as a nonprofit, which is, you know, which puts less of a focus on the bottom line as maybe if you were the commercial certifier. But secondly, sort of after they got started, maybe in the second or third version of the certification standards, they actually spun off the certification standards to an independent standards advisory council. So actually the standards setting is by another entity that is separate from B-Lab. So they've tried to create, you know, some separation between the standards and the certification so that they, you know, to try to mitigate this potential conflict of interest.
This is very, very smart and very interesting. If I want to raise a critique to this, looking at my own profession, my concern is that we live now in a certification and accreditation world, and you can assume that it is normal to certify food or chemical products or hardware, as we've been doing for now many decades. But when it comes to certifying academic programs and putting a lot of constraints around even the most intellectual profession like ours, then I start being a bit skeptical that maybe there is too much of a certification in this planet. So what would you say? Is it correct that everything is going to be stamped and controlled? Or is it a sign that maybe trust is no longer a key regulator of our society and our professions?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I mean, I think it varies by sort of varies by sector, but I think, you know, this issue of trust in companies, is particularly large companies, as you mentioned in one of your questions, is not high, and there's lots of examples of, you know, sort of the famous greenwashing where, you know, companies are communicating about how they're, you know, very socially progressive and forward and doing great things on the environment. But then actually sort of when you peel back the covers and look inside the firm, actually there's a decoupling between sort of the external presentation and inside the company. So I think particularly for companies that having a third party sort of certify and verify what they're doing, I think is important in this realm. You know, given, I mean, the world is just increasing in its complexity. And so, you know, if customers can learn about this, okay, there's this brand that has a B, and if that's on it, I can actually know that the company has been vetted in some ways that other companies have not.
This is a good point. The complexity requires something to help people to understand what they are looking at. Okay, let's move to the final chapter, convincing consumers to care. So, yes, we hear, for example, about Apple producing our devices under extenuating conditions for the workers in southern China, but we don't care. And Apple, for example, managed to dissociate itself from the actual producer of the company, even if it works for them. But yes, consumers do not care particularly. So a question for you and for the founders of the movement: how do you persuade customers to be more careful of the labels, in this case, the social label of what they are going to buy?
Yeah, that's I think, you know, a big challenge for this movement, because it's still, you know, many people don't know about the B Corp logo yet. And I think that you know, it's been around 10 years and you know, I think there's made tremendous progress. I mean, I talked about the laws. One thing I haven't talked about yet, but in investment markets, made tremendous progress in bringing investors along. I think that in large companies, as we discussed, there's been a lot of progress, you know, moving from very small companies to now, you know, some of the largest companies in the world are jumping on this. But actually getting consumers aware of this and the general public aware of this idea and this brand has lagged somewhat. And I think that, you know, I'm optimistic and hopeful that in this next phase of growth, that customers will become much more aware of the B Corp phenomena. A couple reasons why I'm optimistic. I mean, so one is, you know, with these increasing larger companies, it actually means that the brand is becoming much more ubiquitous. So actually, I'm not at home now. I'm actually visiting my family. And, you know, I saw Silk soy milk was in their refrigerator. And I said, okay, Silk is owned by Danone. is the B Corp logo on this? You know, sure enough, it was. I saw in the pantry there was King Arthur flour, another B Corp. I said, is the B Corp logo? Sure enough, actually. So the silk package, it was on the front. The King Arthur flour, it was on the side panel of the flour sack. But they devoted a very large portion of like 1/4 almost of the external packaging, you know, almost the whole panel of the side, you know, devoted to the B logo and what it means. So I think that with these larger organizations, you know, like, you know, Danone, another one, you know, the Gap is a large U.S. Based apparel company, and one of its sub-brands or subsidiaries is called Athleta. It's, you know, relatively well known. It's more sort of it's a women's focused brand of yoga, athletic wear. And they became a B Corp, and they have the B Corp on their tags, a B Corp logo. So I think that it's, you know, for the first decade, you know, it was not on a lot of products yet. You know, things like, you know, Patagonia or Ben & Jerry's had actually very early did not put it on their products. I think Ben & Jerry's has on a number of their products now. I'm not sure about Patagonia yet. It's just an example. So I think that it's going to be in consumers' faces a lot more, which I think obviously will lead to greater consumer resonance. Secondly, I think just demographically, and this also, you know, sort of ties back to my students' interest, you know, when I first started teaching on these topics, you know, very few students were interested. You know, now, you know, it's huge classes because, you know, it's something that really resonates tremendously with, you know, the millennial and Gen Z. So I think that also, you know, demographically, as, you know, those consumers continue buying, and there's scores of studies that show that those millennial and Gen Z consumers want to have their values in their purchases, in their employment. So I think that's another trend that I think will, you know, help this scale. But, you know, you're right to ask about it, because I think that, again, from, you know, employee effects to investors to laws, tremendous, you know, progress over the past decade. And I think, you know, this next decade will really hopefully be about it expanding consumers in a way that it hasn't yet.
Indeed, and this is why we also wish you good luck with selling this book, and the same with B-Lab in doing even more certifications. At this point, I usually ask my guests about their next book, but I see from your CV that this is only your second book, and that your amazing career was based so far on publishing on journals. And for the academics in management, those are the top journals in the planet. You publish on ASQ, Academy of Management, Organization Science, so the top journals. So my question for you is, are you going to invest more time on books, or at least another book, or will you go back to what is standard in academic work for management scholars, which is journals?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'm still actively working on journal articles, and I have a number of those in process. You know, I think that I have two, you know, early stage books in progress. So one is, you know, builds directly off of this set of work. And, you know, and it relates to this idea of externalities. And I think I'm going to do a book on sort of, you know, rolling the covers back on this idea of externalities and how, you know, so many companies are getting basically a free lunch at the expense of the planet and the population. And it's going to, you know, whereas this B Corp book is much more a positive story, you know, let's look at these people that are really contributing well, you know, this book is going to be much more of a, you know, sort of name and shame these companies that, you know, are delivering all kinds of profits to their shareholders, but at the same time, they're polluting their communities. And so, you know, that's and sort of different types of externalities. So, you know, one of the really interesting externalities that I've run into in this research is plastics. You know, it's really much cheaper to use virgin plastic, and you know, it's easier to mold, it's easier to obtain, it's easier, but you know, it's plastic is a material that is around forever. So by using this virgin plastic, you're sort of saving, the company's saving money, but actually passing on a big benefit, a big waste externality to the rest of society. So, you know, there's been a lot of creativity in the companies I've studied on ways of, you know, reducing in some cases to zero plastic. Actually, there's a movement among a number of companies to be plastic neutral. So, you know, finding ways of, you know, if they, you know, have to have plastic for some of their products, because if the product has any sort of liquid or water, it's really hard to do it in, you know, sort of paper or cardboard or even metal. So if companies do this, then they commit to actually, in some ways, you know, taking plastic out of the, you know, sort of, you know, out of the sort of the great plastic heap in the Pacific Ocean or sort of other recycling ways. And so I think sort of, you know, one of the main sets of areas I'm going to be looking at in the next book is on externalities.
Thank you. We look forward to reading your next books. In the meantime, congratulations for Better Business, How the B Corp Movement is Remaking Capitalism. This was published by Yale University Press in 2020. We just spoke with Professor Christopher Marquis. He is a Samuel Johnson Professor in Global Sustainable Enterprise and Professor of Management at Cornell University. Thank you very much for your time, Christopher.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Andrea. It was really nice to talk.